Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel and I am the editor of the TLS. Back alongside me is professional vacationer Thea Leonarduzzi. Thea, hello.
Hello, I believe you were away recently for exactly the same amount of time.
We dealt with Hawaiian pizzas. Lucy was here.
I don't know if
again.
You did, you know.
Hello.
Hi, Lucy.
I felt
that Lucy offered some degree of support for the Hawaiian
pizzas. You said that you used to enjoy them, yeah. Lucy, which implies that you did as a child.
You listened to the podcast.
Your childish tastes.
No, and I'm afraid I have to be honest and admit that it wasn't just as a child.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, you know, each like to their now. Own.
David Horsman and Toby Lichtiger. So we always have a quorum, actually. Hawaiian, yes or no?
Yes.
Toby Lichtiger.
Really, Toby?
Yeah, Toby Lichtiger.
Just quite like
jumping the gun there as well. You just couldn't wait. Yeah, David had to put that on record.
David Horsman?
No.
We also had a tweet from someone, Thea, who actually lived on a volcano in Hawaii, which was cool, I felt. Please do keep your exotic or mundane locations where you listen to this show. You can tweet us at the TLS or email if for good reason you find Twitter a hellish platform of objectionable narcissism. Lots of people have been tweeting from Auckland, Baton Rouge, Cape Town, and we've had some emails as well. Thea, you've had one from John Langridge, I believe.
Oh, I'm going to read it. Okay, so he says, I'm a bit of a traveller, which is understating things rather, and apart from my fishing gear, I also take my tablet with me so that I have listened to you in Rapa Nui, otherwise known as Easter Island, the highlands of Lesotho, Alice Springs, where I fished the completely dry River Todd, which boggles the mind, rather.
Dry fishing.
And I don't know what that is.
No.
Well, anyway.
You just pick them up when they've...
Just stones and dead fish.
Yeah, mudlarking. Yeah. It's different things.
It's easy fishing, I think. It's just you wait till the fish have no water and are dead and you pick them up.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Lhasa, in a monastery called Gandan, where he says, I listened to you at 5,000 metres in a monk's cell that smelled dramatically of yak because of the yak bedspread, yak wax candle, dried yak meat, like biltong, and yak tea.
Yeah, I've been there. No, it's
quite
nice.
Yakky.
Yak tea.
No, I haven't. No, I haven't been there.
I would drink some yak tea. So can we beat that then? That's a good question. Do tweet us if you can go more exotic than that. David Christensen emailed me as well with a photo of the exact centre of Canada.
What?
He did. No, that's where he was listening to us. And he said this, which is, I think, unimprovable. It's a bit flat, as they say around these parts. My dog ran away 2 days ago and I can still see him going.
Brilliant.
I'd stopped here for lunch and spent a pleasant hour listening to the podcast. So there you go. Email me, stig.abel@the-tls.co.uk, or tweet us, and we will continue to hear where you're listening from. If, like David, you want to be a subscriber, he's a digital subscriber in Canada, we've got a cheap deal for you. If you live in the US or Canada, the centre or the margins, go to podcast.the-tls.com. That's podcast.the-tls.com. And if you live anywhere else, including the UK, then go to the-tls.co.uk/pod19. You'll get 5 issues for just £5 or $5. This week, it's the summer book special of the TLS. We'll talk about our contributors' idea of a good summer read and all our owners. As you know, we're joined by a veritable disparagement of TLS editors in the studio. That's the collective noun I'm going for.
I'm happy with
It's very rude.
Not for anyone who spent any time in the TLS offices. They just nod vigorously, I'd have thought. And we might also talk about Midsummer Night's Dream as well, Lucy, if we get a chance.
Yes, let's do that, yeah.
Lovely. Can I start by saying that summer is a terrible time for reading books? It's often too hot. Beaches are not comfortable places for reading. It's full of sand, wind, sea, suntan lotion, and you cannot read books, I don't think, lying flat on your back. Do we all agree with that?
Yes.
I don't.
Have you developed a comfortable position of reading? What do you do? Do you do that thing where you hold the book up so it obscures the sun?
Then, no, because your arms, exactly, tired the lactic acid or whatever it is. No, you form a pillow out of sand or shingle. Mm-hmm. It's less easy on a rocky beach.
Shingle and pillow then, doesn't sound very
and
comfortable,
then,
does
so
it?
So you pad that all out and then you put your towel over that. So that will prop your head up.
Yeah.
So that then you can sort of stare towards your navel.
Yes.
Where you then prop the book on your sort of groin area.
Okay. Nice. Would you like to show us?
I could do, but there's no sound or shingle in the studio.
It's good for podcasts, I think, if you would just show us what it looks like. Yeah. Oh, look.
It makes sense now, doesn't it? And then you just do this.
I never knew Thea was going to do that. But anyway, so there you go. That's Thea's given. I still don't believe it. I like sitting in a room to read. I don't like sitting.
Take your own umbrella. I like that.
All right,
I can't sit in this.
Well, one of our contributors retreats to the dark woods.
Seamus Perry. I prefer dark woods to sun-kissed beaches. I agree with him. What we've done anyway in the paper is we've asked people who write for the TLS what they plan to read this summer, and the answers vary from the incredible to the scarcely credible. We might get to that. In the studio, we have our collective noun of TLS editors, Lucy Dallas, Northern Arts editor, Toby Lichtig, sporadic fiction editor, and David Horsball, right-wing history editor.
Hello. Thank you so much for describing me like that.
It's not true. You vote green, don't you?
That's between me and the voting booth, I believe. I believe it is a secret ballot.
Fine.
I have been described as both right-wing and left-wing, depending on who's doing the reading, so I must be doing something right.
Exactly right. That's the whole BBC defence. So the rules we're going to do first, before we get to our own summer recommendations, we're going to pick a contributor from the paper this week whose suitcase we would like to steal for our own reading pleasure. Because they've recommended such a collection of good books. I was struck by, there's the issue in the literary world of log rolling.
Yes.
Are we all familiar? Everyone is familiar with that, where people say...
We are aware of it.
Yeah. So the idea is someone says, name a favourite book, and you name your girlfriend's book or your publisher's big release, that's issue. Paul Muldoon, one of the greatest living poets... I'm not sure it is log rolling if you're so overt about it. And he says, this summer I'm particularly looking forward to a few books by friends of mine that will, I'm certain, be scintillating. And his friends are Joseph O'Connor, who's got a great new novel, Shadow Play, Edna O'Brien, Kevin Barry, Colson Whitehead, Zadie Smith and Louise Doughty, who are all fairly significant names.
And I'm pretty sure O'Brien and Zadie Smith's books, they're not even available yet in proof, so I think he's obviously been given an advanced manuscript for those, I would imagine.
Which is pretty.
Is Grand Union is it a historical novel?
But Toby doesn't know, no one's seen it.
I haven't seen it yet. I mean,
because I read about that she's doing a historical novel.
No, I don't think it is actually.
It's not that one.
I think it's non-fiction. I think it's non-fiction, but don't quote me on that.
Because you don't know.
Well, we don't like to read that, whatever it is.
Yeah, but Toby's not sufficiently plugged in. I thought that was good too. Toby is no Paul Muldoon when it comes to his literary connectedness.
There was one tiny surprise for me, which is not really about choice, but it was in Jonathan Coe's entry when he talks about Philip Besson's Lie With Me, which he's going to take to the beach, in an English translation by the former Brat Pack actor Molly Ringwald.
Yes!
Now, I had no idea that Molly Ringwald was a translator from the French, as well as a wonderful Brat Pack actor in films such
and
as
an
Breakfast
aunt.
Club.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, she's an agony aunt as well.
I think she's lived there for ages.
Oh, how wonderful.
Mm. Yeah.
And her career, though, possibly as an actor, hasn't developed vastly since the Brat Pack era. Is that the issue?
I actually looked her up. She's been in several films and television shows. I mean, I don't think she's ever quite regained the heights of The Breakfast Club, for example.
I want to watch that with my kids. My kids are 10 and 7. Do we think it would...
Too young.
Do you think they're too young?
Yeah.
Why? They enjoyed Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
10's all right. I'm pretty sure I watched it when I was about 9 or 10.
Really?
I think it's a bit teen.
Yeah, but what do they do that's that naughty? I mean, is it kind of fun naughtiness?
It's a bit of swearing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I swear it's not a problem. We watched Dodgeball at the weekend as a family.
Oh, did you? With a 7-year-old? Yeah. Wow.
They thought it was funny. And also, there's a couple of, I mean, it is funny. There's a couple of Larry lines, but they just, I find with kids, they just don't get them. They don't even, their brain doesn't even touch them. They just, I don't understand that, and moves on.
I used to listen to, Sorry, I Haven't a Clue a lot with one of my boys, who was a great fan of it. And
the Radio 4 show, which is astonishingly rude.
Amazingly, not always, but sometimes amazingly rude. But the brilliant thing was he just wouldn't get it. It just wouldn't occur to him, any of it. And I'd snicker and he would look at me and I'd just go, no, it's okay, don't worry. And as he's got older, unfortunately, he gets more and more of the jokes.
Yeah. My son, we had Jaws. I took Jaws on holiday, which you might get to later. And my son picked it up. And the first word he read began with mother. And ended
in
right. And he's like, what's that? And I was like, really, I'm quite laissez-faire about swearing. I said, you don't swear in front of something, don't swear in front of your grandparents, don't swear at school, but you know, I'm not that bothered about it. But I said, really, that do not say that one in front of virtually anyone, because they will be very unhappy. Anyway, I think that's covered books, summer books, so we'll see you all next week.
You stopped us all into silence, I think.
Yeah. I know. Go on then, who are we going to steal from? Who's going to go? David, go on, steal someone's luggage.
I thought I'd steal Ruth Scurr's luggage.
TLS colleague.
TLS, partly because, I could steal up behind her and she wouldn't realise. She has recommended The Impeachers, The Trial of Andrew Johnson and the Dream of a Just Nation by Brenda Wineapple, about President Johnson being impeached, the accidental president after the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. And he was a terrible, terrible president, a drunk. He, as she says, he ignored Congress, opposed civil rights. He basically tried to turn back the clock to before the Civil War, even though his side, in effect, had won. He was a Republican president. And this book sounds...
What was he impeached for?
Absolutely fascinating. I really can't tell you.
So that's why I'd like to find out. This presumably will do well in Trump's America.
Yes, I think he has been compared. Ever since I read Ron Chernow's book about Ulysses Grant, I've been interested in Andrew Johnson because he comes in between Lincoln and Grant as the president. And so he's a very fascinating character, and Chernow writes about him very well. And I know that Chernow's recommended this book as well. He's given it a sort of golden opinion. So he sounds a very interesting character. And yeah, of course, he's very reminiscent of someone closer to home, as it were.
Who launched his leadership.
He did. About plan. Keeping America great.
Florida's now a Trump state.
He wasn't concerned about overlapping with the British Tory Party debate.
Imagine his numbers would have been significantly down because of that, probably. Yeah.
Surely.
Yeah. Let's not get into that. Okay, someone else, go on. Someone else steal something.
I would quite like to steal Muriel Zagger's.
I wanted to steal Muriel Zagger's, but go on.
Sorry.
No, go on.
Well, she's reading Rebecca, which I'm in.
I read this year for the first time.
I now can't remember whether I've read it.
It's brilliant.
You've seen the film.
No, I don't think I have.
So you've seen the film as well.
I think I've read it.
Yeah, it's also, it was pitched as a, what I find fascinating, it was pitched as a romantic novel. And it's literally got no romance in it whatsoever. The only romance in it is really Mrs. Danvers for the dead Rebecca. That's the only act of kind of pure love in the whole book. Everyone else is kind of awkward and awful.
Stretching romance a bit as well, that, I think.
Great, great gay icon, Mrs. Danvers.
Sure.
I've never seen the film. Yeah. Is it good?
Oh, my gosh. It's amazing. It's one of my favourite films.
Really?
Hitchcock, yeah.
It's extraordinary, yeah.
I try not to. I don't watch Sherlock Holmes films. I like reading the books. I don't like...
The Sherlock Holmes. Is it Jeremy Brett, that series?
Yeah. So it's Basil. Is it Basil Rathbone as well?
Razzle Bathbone. Very good.
And the new one. Have you seen the new one?
The
newish one.
Well, the new film or the Benedict Cumberbatch?
Benedict Cumberbatch, yeah.
It's pretty good. Like, it's not much like Sherlock Holmes.
I only like the old, really mannered, slightly odd ones.
Mm. I love the book. I reread the books every year, all the time. They're so good. My daughter's just getting into them as well, and they're so brilliant. All right,
It's not Rebecca, actually. That's not why I'm. This is why I'm sitting here going, I think I've read it. The one I'm interested in is the Ulipo.
Oh,
that
sounds
don't
great.
Groan, no. Stig. I'm allowed to be interested in it.
No, I love Ulipo because I'd only ever heard of it at the TLS because Bob Potts, the managing editor, always talks about Ulipian constraints.
He does. He does indeed.
It's
the rules that we impose on ourselves. Because she starts by talking about Georges Perec, who did La Disparition, which is the novel without an E. Which sounds, it was sort of, well, it wasn't a joke. It sounds like a joke, but it was done for serious reasons. Well, I have to say, I haven't read it into full disclosure.
Because his parents disappeared in the Holocaust, and so E is
It's like having the most important thing stripped out.
De, as in, of them.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And also, and it's like the most, because E is the most used letter, it's like having the most important part of your the heart of something
by loss.
Can you survive without it? How do you survive without it, kind of thing? But Ulipo generally is often quite jolly.
Because it's game playing generally, is that right?
It's just they impose rules on their writing, and they're not always obvious. But the trick is to make the writing good without knowing what the rule is or having to be bound.
So what are the other rules? Is it always a sort of lipogram, no E's or no A's or something?
They're often quite mathsy.
You need to read the book, don't you?
I do need to read the book. Well, there's also it's not a set of rules. It's just that each member comes up with their own, and you don't have to do it. It's just a sort of spirit of playfulness and
to channel your creative.
I totally get that, because when you read a lot of modern poetry, which has no rules in it, it often, I think, just reads like prose that's just been cut up. If you have a poetic style, which is pretty common now, where you don't have forced, rhyming positions or rhythms or whatever, I think that makes it's harder to appreciate, because it just everything reads like prose that's been artificially cut up.
Yes, well, you have to make your own choices at every turn, don't you? And the thing about the Ulipian rules is that you can make them significant. Do you see what I mean? They can be statistically significant, or you can, as we said about the E, there was a deeply serious reason for doing it, but they're not all serious. And she was saying, she didn't realise that they're still going, and they still have, I think it's still,
there's a group.
I tried to go to one
group?
Once. Yeah, you have to be invited. Mm. And I think they're still, I think you can go to some sort of public evenings in Paris every now and again where Ulipo still meet up and do things, which is just so great.
You should go along.
You should.
I tried to once and I missed it, but I would love
that. Is about the most French arty thing to do in the world, isn't it? Go to a
Ulipo. But it sounds pretentious, but it's really good fun, a lot of it.
Could you not try and go and write about it?
Well, that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah. How do you do that?
You pay for my train fare and I go to Paris and write about it.
Let's do that.
Brilliant.
And you take me, of course.
Okay.
No.
That sounds like a jolly.
Anyone else? Yeah. David and Toby interested in
definitely.
It?
Definitely.
Yeah. That's good. Go on. Another one. Another. Toby.
Andrew Motion has chosen a book that I was going to take with me anyway, so I don't know whether there's any point in pilfering his bag, because I own it, but I'm gonna do
which,
it.
Which one?
So it's The Uninhabitable Earth by Davis Wallace Wells, which is about climate change, which, along with lots of other people this year, I've become increasingly obsessed with. It grew out of this article that the author wrote for the New York Magazine a couple of years ago, and it got quite a lot of stick. It's incredibly alarming.
It was too catastrophic, wasn't it?
Too, in inverted commas, catastrophic. Yeah. And lots of people, including concerned climate scientists, said there's no point in being so catastrophic about it because it's just going to scare people into inaction. For me, I'm finding that fear is more of a driver to action. Not that I'm, doing an awful lot to change the world, but I find that fear is at least getting me thinking about stuff. And he then turned this article, which is quite long already, I think it's about 7,000 words, into a book, and I think he doubles down on his alarmism in it. Alice Attlee reviewed it for us last month, but I'm interested in the debate about where you pitch these things as much as anything
and
else.
We had that oddly optimistic paper a couple of weeks ago, didn't we, where Naomi Klein...
Yeah, and we had Joseph Stiglitz
as
well,
and
Kate
all weird, and that, I found them too optimistic. I didn't buy it at all, because, you could look at, say, the Green performance in the European elections. Oh, the Greens are doing quite well. This argument that the Green New Deal is going to work because people are in such economic difficulties that they'll go for such a significant change which will fix both economy and environment in one fell swoop.
I think it was, for me, that issue was very persuasive on the lines of, this is what we need to do, this is how to fix it, and reducing inequality and tackling climate change are linked, they're not different things. I feel slightly less optimistic about whether we are able to do that,
but also, as we see, Trump announces last night he could well be up against Joe Biden. Now, Joe Biden, I'm sure, will have environmental credentials of sorts, but he's not going to be running on a ticket, he's going to be running on a centrist ticket, which is don't shake things up too much.
Yep.
He might well lose, in which way he's at Trump for 4 more years. In which case, this is all kind of, you know, we have the Tory party leadership there. There may be, may or may not be a general election. If there is, the Tories may scrape together, they may not.
Yeah, absolutely. And we and you know, everyone's trumpeting sort of 12 years at the moment. That seems to be the figure that lots of scientists are hitting on. We have 12 years to sort this out. I mean, I'm sure it's a fairly spurious figure. But yeah, it's not like we have 50 years to sort it out.
Have any of us ever read a good climate?
Yes. So I read a book last month called Falter by Bill McKibben, which we're going to be covering later this summer, and it's both about climate change and AI, but it's very lucid, it's both alarmist, but there is a bit of optimism in it.
What's that classic book, Dan Carlson,
Silent Spring. Yeah,
I've never read that. I'm reading that later this year.
Right.
Does anyone ever read that? Cause that's supposed to be the text for the environmental thing. That's one of my books I'm going to be reading this summer. So maybe this is a moment. Does this feel like a moment?
Well, to me, it feels like another moment in which we're all talking about it again. But, I mean, if the political will isn't there, and the political will seems to be there a little bit in China, but you can't tell, you can't sort of put much pressure on the Chinese. They'll do what they want to do, as, you know, they do to their population. And obviously we know, as we've just been saying, about what's happening in America, and those are the two biggest polluters, and then India will become one of the biggest. So I think within the EU, and the British seem to want to keep in step with that. They said
there's a commitment
fine
to 20,
things.
2050, isn't there?
Yeah, wanting to expand Heathrow, etc. So, yeah, I think it is to do with political will.
But we're talking about it more, aren't we? That's true, yeah. But you can look at that in two ways, can't you?
And I just think democracies put pressure on their political leaders.
Exactly. So all one can do is carry on talking about it and keep it in the public eye as much
and
as possible.
Stop traffic on Oxford Circus. You can do that too.
Well, actually, we were saying, Toby, that got a lot of stick, the climate extinction stuff, but it did make people talk about
absolutely.
It.
I think they've had an enormous effect in this country. I think it's been they've been incredibly, incredibly effective.
Yeah, I think that too. And actually, and also, they were very, very careful about being courteous and, you know, apart from sort of stopping traffic, they were completely kind of within the law and being very clear to say, look, we're sorry about this. We don't want to do this. We're not just doing it to be annoying. We're doing it because we really feel this is important for everybody.
I guess the question is, people shouldn't be taking these books and going on a plane and going on holiday, because that's the other thing that's going to have to happen, is everyone's going to have to start changing what they regard as basic requirements of life, that you go on holiday somewhere hot once a year or twice a year. Because in the end, that's going to have to stop, I would imagine.
Which is, again, why expanding Heathrow isn't something that should be happening, and instead we should be putting our money into developing infrastructure that is greener, like trains.
I was reading something about someone saying what we need to do, and that, you know, the fear is that if someone goes, well, you can't, you know, you have to become, everyone's worried that you have to become vegan and never go anywhere and not have any children and all of that kind of thing. But actually the guy was saying, no, just cut back a bit.
Yeah.
Because if everybody does a bit less, I don't mean the children.
We've all done quite a lot of that in the past 30, 40 years, changed our habits in all sorts of ways.
It doesn't kill us to not have
continue
a burger.
To, you know, put the TLS in a compostable bag, that sort of thing.
The triumph that was. Right, Thea. Steal a book for us.
I'm going to position myself in customs and blow open a number of people's suitcases so that I can ferret through and select.
I like the idea of that.
So I'm going to take a number of people have mentioned Night Boat to Tangier by Kevin Barry. So I'm going to take that one. I might take Marion Turner's Chaucer, A European Life,
which we review this week.
Yes, which is set to help us to understand the grand puzzle of how a wine merchant's son came to write the Canterbury Tales.
Yeah, and he goes to Milan.
He was a diplomat in Milan.
Yeah, lovely.
So I'll take that as well. And then there was another one. I really like the sound of The Bells of Old Tokyo, Travels in Japanese Time by Anna Sherman. In part because I just think something strange happens to our concept of time in the summer. Maybe because if you're away, certainly you're less aware of what time it is. You've not got your phone, you've not got your screen with the time on it. You're not going to the station and looking at what time train you're getting.
Stig's looking very bemused these days, I'd say.
Imagine.
Stig's in the dark,
and so you tell the time through other means, the sun, church bells, all that sort of
thing. Oh, that sounds so idyllic.
Yeah.
Mm. I'm not sure that's what...
You can do it. You just put your phone down.
Anyone away with the children, how much reading do you do in the summer?
So I've just been away with the children for a week and I have done very little reading. It's difficult. There were water slides to go on.
Yes. Why would you read?
That was just
where
you
can go on a water slide.
And they have to be old enough to play each other at cricket, and then you're allowed to.
Then you're allowed to read. Well, we're going to find out. Toby will be lying about what he's going to read this summer because he's only going on water slides, but we'll come to that next.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Now, before we move on to our books recommendations, we're going to keep things seasonal with some thoughts on the new A Midsummer Night's Dream at the Bridge Theatre in London, because, Lucy Dallas, you sent me to it.
I did
to
indeed.
Review it, which I then did, and then you went to see it, which is nice when you've
just
been...
to check that you...
It was suspiciously... Lucy, I gave Lucy the review on Thursday, and she went at the weekend... which I felt was like a sort of a fact-checking exercise.
Fact-checking, yeah.
She did find something as well.
Absolutely not fact-checking. I had booked it ages ago because I thought that I was interested in that show anyway.
It's really good. I mean, if people are in London over the summer, it's on for quite a while, isn't it?
It's on until the end of August, yeah.
Yeah, so it's such a good... So the Bridge Theatre has this amazing space where you can be a promenade member of the audience, which means you stand in the pit and the stage is it moves up and down... and it gets pushed around by people. So you're part of an audience that moves with the production. And this is a very funny, very irreverent version of Midsummer Night's Dream. And the clever little trick in it is that they switch around the roles of Oberon and Titania. So Puck is Titania's little sprite. And so that means Oberon falls in love with Bottom, not Titania. And so it leads to... It's part of this sort of whole chaotic, irreverent... things going on in the forest, and it's funny and it's clever, and we both really liked it, didn't we?
Really liked it.
Some people did not like it, and some people, and I saw them because I was at the press night, and they were sitting there nursing their warm wine and their paunches and looking a little disapproving. I mean, I've seen quite a lot of Midsummer Night's Dreams, and they're all a bit irreverent because the nature of the play is pretty... You know, it's jocular and it sort of messes around with concepts of order and straightforwardness. But this one is pretty... Do you think it's fairly irreverent on the scale, Lucy?
It is. I don't really mind about that. If it works within the play, if it understands the play, you know, which this one deeply seems to, or, you know, not that there's one way of understanding it, but it's very faithful, I think, to the spirit of the play and also to a lot of the letter. It just adds some gags, which seems... perfectly legitimate because it's a funny play, and I just thought the spirit of the whole thing was really nice. And I mean, I don't know how would you know this, but it felt quite Shakespearean, and it was very democratic.
And it's quite a young audience, wasn't it?
Very young audience.
And they seemed to be enjoying it?
They were totally, totally up for
it. I mean, if you're a groundling, and you should only do it, I mean, I think if you buy a ticket, you should become a groundling. You get dragged into it in a way that, you know, let me reassure you, I'm not someone who wants to get immersed at any stage. I don't want to be involved. And I could stand back from that enough that it was still fun, but I'm not, you know, putting on a silly wig and dancing about the place. They do a caper. You know how at the Globe, at the end of the plays, they do capers? David, your face indicates...
Yes, I've seen the capers.
Not good, is it?
Well, it's particularly bad if you've seen a tragedy and, you know, Macbeth has ended. I saw a brilliant Macbeth at the Globe a few years ago, and feeling suitably gloomy and horrified. And then they started capering.
Yeah,
and
I didn't know where to put myself. And have a caper.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, you know, that's what because they did. I'm not an Elizabethan theatre goer.
No, and so it works better in them as a comedy anyway, so you're not really shifting tone. The caper in this is really good.
It's an excellent caper.
Yeah. I won't ruin it in case anyone goes to see it, but I've sat there watching, you know, and they prance around. It's all very Hey Nonny. It's all a bit Disneyfication of Shakespeare, and you think, oh, for God's sake. And there is that question, you know, with Greek tragedies, when they put them on, they put three tragedies in a satyr play, which was a comedy. They obviously like their mangling of genres in the past, but maybe we're a bit more austere than that. I'm always struck by a few. The puns in Shakespeare, I love a pun, as you know, but, you know, in all of the tragedies, there are moments of sort of high moving drama, which then immediately punctured by a bit of wordplay. You know, I think when even in like the history plays, when Hotspur dies, I think someone says, well, he's now Coldspur or something like that.
Yes.
And you think,
Roger Moore raising an eyebrow as he dispatches a baddie.
Yeah,
yes.
is that the time for that joke? In Titus Andronicus, there's loads of gags, and you think, but obviously that was the taste that they had. But anyway, this is a comedy. It's funny, and the capering is good.
And it's directed. I think the sort of vision of it is Nick Heitner, isn't it? And it just seems to me kind of brilliantly orchestrated and directed and all that. And a really, I would say, flawless cast.
Right, books. What books? How do you want to do this? Shall we say the books we intend to take away or to read this summer? Ambition or reality?
Yes, I mean, but with the caveat that having been away last week, I'm going to tell you about a book that I've already read.
Fine, that's okay. I think with someone who holidays as much as you, some of it is necessarily going to be in the past as much as the future.
Well, yes.
Right, Joy Morthea, tell us what you read last week.
Okay.
I know what you read last summer.
Well, yes, because there's an audio record, surely.
Yeah.
I read Barbara Pym, Excellent Women.
Ah, that keeps getting featured, doesn't
novel.
It?
Well, Barbara Pym is obviously a favourite of the paper because Philip Larkin in our much talked about underrated, overrated feature from the 60s, was it?
77.
Well,
we haven't talked about it.
Yeah, exactly.
From 1977, he mentioned Barbara Pym as underrated. And I'd never read Excellent Women, which is her second novel, and one of the most talked about ones, actually, from 1952. And it's just this brilliant comedy of manners. The perfect, I think, at the moment in particular, I seem to be pining for a different sort of Britishness, which is the quiet, self-deprecating Britishness that we just don't see or hear of anymore.
The Rory Stewart of novels.
And it's, I mean, the names.
David, you look disapproving. I don't mean that. I'll take that back.
The names are just fantastic in themselves. Mildred Laidbury is the narrator, a spinster who's only in her 30s. Rockingham Napier, Everard Bone. It's just a series of anti-climaxes, delightful anti-climaxes.
Is it too gentle?
It's so funny. It's very gentle, but it's so clever. It's so well studied. Basically, the title is a phrase that men of the period used to refer to women who were very good at doing menial but important things, like writing the indexes for the male author's books and things like that.
Quite right, too.
And it's just very funny. Funnily enough, my husband is reading Andrew Motion's at the same time as reading Andrew Motion's biography of Larkin, so there was a nice dovetailing going on as well.
Is that the reissue?
He's reading the reissue,
and that caused a massive controversy, didn't it?
Yes.
This is where he exposes Larkin,
the real Larkin, not Teddy Bear Larkin. So there's that, and then I was also dipping into Lavinia Greenlaw. I think her most recent collection, The Built Moment, which is a collection of poems about her father's slide into dementia.
Someone else mentioned that.
They mentioned her memoir.
Yeah,
somebody
her
mentioned
memoir.
Her memoir.
Oh, yeah. Frieda Hughes, Lavinia Greenlaw's The Importance of Music to Girls.
Yes.
Seen through the heady mix of extracts from her life, from her first kiss to the birth of her first child, as seen through the prism of music.
Yeah, and I suppose, well, in The Built Moment, it's sort of seen through the prism of time, or the passage, our understanding of time, and how her father sort of is retreating ever more into the present moment. As Alzheimer's takes effect. So dipping into that, which I'll continue to do this summer.
So you read poetry on holiday?
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes.
I wonder how common that is.
It's, well...
Not very, but it should be more common because it's jolly portable, isn't it?
Yeah.
There is also
and
that.
And it's easy to just do it for 10 minutes rather than...
Yeah.
And, do you find yourself taking lots of books on holiday?
Well, I also took Milkman by Anna Burns, which I keep on sort of starting and then being distracted by. And I'm going to continue it because I'm really enjoying it, but I only got a couple of... 150 pages in.
It's very funny. It's very
yeah, it is. It's really, and I saw her read from it at Hay as well, and at Hay Festival, and she reads her own work so well, which you can't say about every author.
No.
But she just reads. She's so funny. So I'll continue with reading that. And today on the train, funnily enough, someone got on the train when I got on the train and started reading Milkman. And then at some stage, this woman got off. And the next time I looked up again, there was someone else sitting opposite me also reading Milkman by Anna Burns.
Whoa. Oh, my God. Mm.
It sold extremely well. And it was when she won, there are a few sniffy things written about how it was it was an unpopular choice and it wasn't going
to
sell.
It's hard.
Well.
Wasn't it supposed to be too hard?
Too hard. Yeah. Nonsense. It's not
seems
hard.
To be selling
it's just
very
brilliant.
Well.
And it is. It's in fact, it's selling a lot better than, for example, George Saunders's.
Well, the last three or four haven't sold crazily well, have they? So this was kind of a moment where the Booker of...
Yeah.
Because also Irish novelists are hugely on trend at the moment, aren't they?
And The Troubles also very, very pertinent.
Yeah, that's very true. Does anyone else take books around? Has anyone ever hoiked a book around that they've never ended up reading?
Oh, God, I do that every year. I take too many books because I have this terror of, finishing.
Running out.
Which, of course, since I've had children is ludicrous.
Barely
finish one. But
when you take sort of six with you. Is there any you've never got around to that you've just always desperately wanted to take? I'm just trying to think if I've ever...
I spent about 5 years taking Pale Fire on holiday with me, and then I finally read it, and it's obviously extraordinary and brilliant.
Yeah.
That was one.
Is Nabokov a summer book? I mean, because that's the thing, how hard a book can you take? I once read...
Go hard.
Do you?
Because assuming that you've got some time to sit back or whatever, I don't really want to read a thriller on the beach. I want to...
Really?
Think.
Well, does it depend on where you're going?
No.
You don't want to read a thriller on the beach. No. You'd rather read.
I know lots of people do, and that's if I've got time to reflect and not be in my normal world and thinking about work and emails and phone calls and all the rest of it, I actually want to be challenged. I think.
So really? What are you taking?
Yeah, what's going to challenge
you?
Well, actually, I've said that very high mindedly, but nothing that challenging. Yeah. So I've
yeah.
Spice World
Asterix, actually. No, so like Thea, I've also recently been on holiday, and I had two books with me, neither of which I finished because, well, for aforementioned reasons to do with small children. But they're both
and water slides.
Absolutely. One is the Topeka School, I don't know how to pronounce it, by Ben Lerner. It's Ben Lerner's new novel. It's not actually out here till November, I think. It's fantastic. Ben Lerner was mostly well known as a poet until reasonably recently, and then he wrote the novel Leaving the Atocha Station and then 1002, both of which are fantastic. This is even better.
Paul Muldoon's probably read it.
Yeah, I'm sure he has. Yeah, he probably wrote it.
Yeah.
It's
what sort of novel is this then?
Lerner writes autofiction. I know that raises some eyebrows that people don't always like autofiction, but he does it in a very clever and charming way. This is clearly semi-autobiographical. It's set in Kansas, where Lerner grew up. It doesn't reinvent the wheel. It's a very charming book about family. It's set amongst this community of psychotherapists. I'm married to a psychotherapist, so that intrigues me. It's very funny. It's about family dynamics. It's about betrayal, and it's just very, very well written. The other book is Three Women by Lisa Tadeo,
which we are extracting,
which
in
we
the
are
Trans-
extracting in a future
two
edition
weeks.
Of the TLS.
2 weeks.
I haven't finished this one partly because my wife stole it from me and then gave it to her friend. She said it wasn't for me. It's about female desire. I disagree with her.
Exactly.
But it's utterly brilliant.
That's a sign of a good book, isn't it?
It is.
Your wife not only stole it from you, then gave it
to
someone
else.
Yeah.
She's a journalist, Lisa Today. It's her first book. She spent 8 years with three different women. It's called Three Women. There are actually other women that he dropped out of her study, talking to them about sexual desire and about their lives. She was so immersed in these women's lives that she actually moved house to live near one of them and then another one of them. She, 8 years, it's this incredibly well-written, fine-grained study. She actually started off writing about male desire, but found that it was so boring to her, and so obvious that she just gave up, which I think is quite funny. And it's unlike anything I've ever read. It's been getting
Rosdanine loves it.
It's getting a lot of advanced praise. It's not out, I think, till July. There's been a little bit of criticism as well because there are only three women, they're all white women. There's no homosexuality in it. It's all about straight white desire. But it's not pretending to be this enormously comprehensive encyclopedic study. Yeah. And it's just
it's kind of a boring argument that she's written a book. This is the book she's written. Exactly. It's either a good book or a bad book.
Yes. People are welcome to go and write different books and contribute to it. But as a contribution to a study of female desire, I think it is.
And indeed, no doubt the way that publishing works, if this book does well, we will be drowning in a series of books that sound a bit like this, which could cover all sorts of topics, because that's how publishing works, isn't it? Someone does well, you then get everyone five different versions of the same. But David Horsepool, do you read history on holiday?
I tend to quite a lot.
Do you?
I mean, I also read novels on holiday. My last holiday, I read A Bridge Too Far by Cornelius Ryan. Cornelius Ryan was an Irish journalist turned historian who became obsessed with American military exploits and wrote A Bridge Too Far about the Arnhem campaign. And he also wrote The Longest Day about D-Day. So he wrote the two books on which two of my favourite war films are based. And A Bridge Too Far, he wrote in the last year of his life, battling cancer, and he didn't take his painkillers so that he could write it. And it's an incredible book, actually, and it's more extraordinary than some of the episodes in the film, which are sort of slightly unbelievable. The kind of man who carries around an umbrella because he can't remember the password.
That's absolutely true. I wrote about him in my book because he said he carried an umbrella, and someone said there's guns out there. He goes, don't worry, I don't have a gun, I've got an umbrella. And then he attacked a tank, I believe, with his umbrella.
And
he rammed it through the slit and killed someone.
Yes, he did
with his umbrella.
And yes, he crossed a road with a padre and they were under fire. And he said, it's all right, I've got an umbrella. And then in fact, in the film he dies, but in reality he was captured and escaped. And during his escape across Holland, he helped some Wehrmacht soldiers get their jeep out of a ditch or something and just pretended to be a mute Dutch farm worker or something, and they didn't question him, and then he walked on. He was the most extraordinary character. But anyway, that was one Cornelius Ryan.
Wise Heart or something like that.
Yeah.
I have written about it.
It is. Anyway, it's full of stories like that, and I'm sure that Longest Day will be too. It's probably not the best history of D-Day now available because there are plenty of others
much
coming out.
The James Holland 44,
and Andy Beaver's written about it. There's a big book by Peter Caddy Adams. There are all sorts, but I probably won't be reading those. The one I'm probably going to take on holiday is a book by Charles Emerson called Crucible: The New Long End of the Great War and the Birth of a New World, 1917 to 1924, which makes it sound incredibly boring, but actually what it is a sort of mass diary of an age of 1917 to 24 in short bursts, going all around the world, and everybody from Einstein to Mussolini is in it, and Tristan Zara, and just small extracts, maybe a page or two.
That's
or a few
idea,
paragraphs. And he's done it a bit before he did it with 1913 and our reviewer Jay Winter liked that very much, and it just strikes me as extremely readable and dip-intable. So I'm looking forward to that.
That sounds really good. What a good idea. And the idea of world history is kind of trendy now, isn't it?
Absolutely.
There aren't this criticism of three women, the narrowness. That seems to be something that people try and avoid at all costs, don't they? That if you're going to
people broaden it out. I mean, of course, there's also the kind of narrow. There's a book coming out, which I've just found a reviewer for, about the Lyons family of the tea shops and so on. And they're a great Jewish immigrant family who their connection with English history from the 19th century up to the 50s and 60s. And it's told by Thomas Harding, who's a descendant of theirs. And it looks really fascinating. That book,
so that's kind of legacy. Hyper-local. Lucy, go on. You're a big reader.
Yes. I mean, I am.
I've got,
there's a book that I own and a book that I'd be interested in. The book that I own is one that I bought in a really nice independent bookshop in Edinburgh, and I was just looking around, and it's graphic novels. I'm going to just get it out there first. Or comics. You could say
comics.
No one
objects to comics here.
Okay.
I don't read them. Although I try, because I read Watchmen. Mm. And I've worked out that this is not a criticism of graphic novels. I think my brain doesn't process information in panels in the same way it does in words on the page. So I find it quite hard to follow the narrative thread of comics to know who people are. My brain doesn't click. Whereas if I read a page of narrative... and I remember people, I was tweeting about it, and people have said the same thing. I think you have a brain that responds to comics or doesn't. It's not necessarily, it's not a snobbish thing. It's a kind of how your brain processes information. I don't have a very visual brain, I don't think.
Well, I've read a lot of comics.
So you know,
maybe, I don't know.
Maybe you've taught yourself. What's this
graphic novel? This one is, I think the latest installment in a series called Love and Rockets, which I have loved since... for a long time, let's just say for a long time. It's a series. It's two brothers, the Hernandez brothers, and one of them follows a set of people in California. They're in a kind of barrio, and it's Hispanic community. It's mostly in English, but they do a bit of Spanish. And it's just following, there's two main characters, two women called Maggie and Hopi. And it's a bit science fiction and funny and silly sometimes, and then sometimes it's quite serious and it's about family and relationships. And he's carried on with these same characters, so they're middle-aged women now. I haven't read any for quite a while, and this is one that's just out, and I pounced on it. And I'm just really looking forward to it, because I do feel... it's just very, very good storytelling.
It's nice when you get a continuing series of.
Well,
you've
sort of grown up with them, in a sense.
Yeah, I like them. I've been a mechanic on space rockets, you know, that sort
for
of
many
thing.
Years.
Been
yeah,
in a very influential punk band, you know, that
that's
kind
of almost
thing.
True, actually.
It's really not true.
Well, you were in a non-influential indie band.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you. but the other one is,
that's
and
true,
the other one
it?
Is.
It's better than no band at all, Lucy.
Yeah. Let's say, yes, it is. The other one is, there's a new book by Laurent Binet, who wrote The Seventh Function of Language and Ash, 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 Ash. And it's going to be called Civilisation, which, you know...
needs no translation.
There we go. It's not out till August. And it seems to be a kind of counterfactual.
And you love Binet, don't you?
I do love him. Yes, I do. The Seventh Function of Language, I thought, was cracking.
Which was about Bart and the... and
yes,
death,
it was kind
it?
Of hijinks.
Bart being run over by an ambulance, sort of. Is that
bread van?
Sorry,
I want to say bread van.
I thought it was laundrette or something. Can't remember.
Gaudi was
laundry
run
van.
Over
it's
by
laundry van. Van. Laundry yeah. van. Yeah. A van anyway. Containing
oh, no, that was
some
a tram. Sorry, Gaudi was run over by a tram.
There's a okay. piece in that. Authors and their vehicular accidents.
But this one, I think, is kind of world spanning and sounds a bit more serious.
Does it contain real historical personages like his previous fiction? Do we know?
I think so. It's a sort of counterfactual. It looks as though it looks as though the kind of Incas are going to invade Europe, and it's kind of what would have happened.
Did that happen, David Horsfall?
It did not happen. Gibbon speculated about if the Muslim invasions had carried on up to up to and beyond Paris and up the Cam and so on.
Did he?
Yeah.
Because he stops in the decline and fall with the rise of the Mongols and Genghis
yes,
Khan and all that.
Yes, it goes on and on and on. But yeah, I don't think the Incas ever made it.
Well, that sounds very good. We're running out of time, so I won't do mine. Except to say, because I'm writing this book on what to read on the commute, so I'm reading different types of books. So each month I do a different type of book, so I'm reading plays at the minute, but next month I'm doing comic fiction, and I'm going to read Love in a Cold Climate. By Nancy Mitford, which I've never
one
read.
One of the greats.
I just started Diary of a Nobody.
Are you enjoying it?
Yeah.
By Grossmith.
Absolutely love.
That's Pooter, isn't it?
Pooter, the Grossmiths, yeah. I would have thought that would be brilliant commuter fiction.
I think it's quite a lot. My list of comics, talking to Lucy about my list of comic fiction, there is some quite good. But you made me read one which I didn't enjoy, which was.
Which one?
Any Fool Know, the thing these people who say. The cartoon.
Oh, Molesworth.
Molesworth.
I can't believe you didn't enjoy Molesworth.
I didn't really get
Molesworth. It's dated a little bit.
Do you think?
Well, yeah. I mean, some of it's in... You have to know... Yes, quite a bit of it's in Latin. But you don't have to know Latin.
No, exactly. No. I thought it was fine, but not funny. But I've never read Love in the Cold Climate, so I'm going to read that, and I'm going to reread A Confederacy of Dances.
I was about to ask you if you have Confederacy of Dances on your... Yes, it is so brilliant.
Yeah. And so sad in lots of ways, because he died after... He killed himself, didn't he, before publication. His mum got it published.
Yeah. And it's his only novel, isn't it?
It's his only novel, and I can only... What's the name of the character? I can't remember the character. Augustus or something like that. Is it?
Yes. What's he called?
It's a funny name. Anyway, have you read it?
Yes, I don't remember it being terribly funny, though. I mean, I thought it was very good.
Yeah. It's weird. Yeah. I'm really looking forward to...
It's quite gross.
Yeah, it's one of those books that I've only read once, and I think rereading... There's books that you read, I read it hundreds of times, but there's a book where you just think, I can't quite grasp it in my mind. I can see the cover. I can remember reading it.
John Kennedy O'Toole,
and it was... I read it when I was 18.
Lots of funny stuff about working in a very dreary office doing very pointless tasks.
Well, and there's that question of what's the best office novel, because there's things like Something Change, which is Joseph Heller's great office novel, which he wrote after Catch 22.
Oh, that's a brilliant novel.
Horrible, yes. but the bits before it gets horrible are really funny about working in an office. Bartleby the Scrivener, of course.
Is Joshua Ferris wrote quite a good one.
Yeah, it's very good. Yeah. Joshua Ferris.
Maybe that's a good thing to read in the summer when you escape your
read
office.
Read about the office? Come on.
It's like when you dream about the office and you wake up and then you have to go to work.
Yeah. book about working in a newspaper office.
Oh, it's towards the end of the morning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant.
Finally, to loop the loop, it's Ignatius J. Reilly.
Ignatius. Well done, Thea.
Yes. It's a really good book, and, well, I hope it is.
I read it for the first time not that long ago, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and I loved it. So, oh yeah, I'd be interested to know if you think it's...
Fine. I will report back. We've run out of time. I mean, that was a pretty wide range of summer books. Bit of history, bit of graphic novels.
I'm going to pitch a follow-up to your book, which is holiday reading.
Yes.
In which someone will have to commission me to go on various holidays and find...
How can we
find
tell?
The reading
I don't think you need that sort of encouragement.
Do you know what, though?
I need the banker.
Then you really would be a professional vacationer.
Well, exactly.
That'd be absolutely brilliant. And also, I do like contextual reading.
You've created this monster.
But I know you like reading books, so that's why when I went on holiday to Sussex, this is a bit of a stretch, by the sea, I took Jaws.
That's such a stretch.
Yeah, so I was sitting there, and you hear the sort of wash of the waves, and you read a bit of Jaws.
The wash of the English Channel.
And I tell you what, I remember vividly reading Our Mutual Friend, Dickens's last completed novel, which is about the Thames in a very wet, miserable, wintry time. I used to live by the Thames, and I remember reading that and travelling to work, miserable rain, and reading Dickens. And the context definitely made... that's my favourite Dickens book, and I went out because I read it in exactly the right place to read it. So there may be a book there for
There's
you.
There's a book
there.
In it for me.
You could go to, you know, read Thomas Mann in a sanatorium
I think
somewhere.
Maybe it should be a theme park, and you have a different series of rooms where you read Bleak House in a kind of ruined mansion.
Or a hotel, maybe.
And yes. Toby could do some reading
a
water slide.
Maybe. But it'd have to
what
be
book would you,
like a much smaller budget.
It's a huge budget.
Yeah. All right. Thea, we'll work on that. You will become next
Publishers,
year.
Publishers, do drop me a line.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm ready.
Thea is available. thank you to everyone who's contributed to the entire perplexity of TLS editors. Disparagement's probably better. Toby, Lucy and David, do get subscribing to the paper. This week is a good one. We've got a rereading of John Fowles, French Lieutenant's Woman. British radio face palmer James O'Brien looks at the Corbyn Labour Party. Neil Gaiman picks his favourite SF novel of the last 50 years, which, Lucy, you've read.
I read it because of this. I read it for Workstig, imagine.
Oh, my God. Did you enjoy it? What's it called?
I really did. It's called The Book of New Earth, isn't it? Oh, no, the first one's called The...
The Book of the New Sun.
But it's about the torturer. The first one is called The Shadow of the Torturer, I think.
Oh, God.
It's a series by Gene Wolfe.
Yeah, it's really... deep, knotty. Some of it's absolutely brilliant, and some of it's a bit mystifying. But I think that's probably my fault rather than his. It's very, very rich, brilliant stuff.
And this is a point that Neil Gaiman makes in the piece as well, isn't it? How you sort of have to come back to it older and wiser, almost, or older and different.
I'm old. I mean, I don't know about the rest of it.
Older and different, anyway.
Well, it's a really interesting piece. Yeah, there's a reissue of this book called The Book of the New Sun by Gene Wolfe. So that's well worth reading. Next week, Thea has written the lead essay in the paper about the art of the gesture. Let's see how well that translates into an audio product like this podcast. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.